This is the Planning Commission work session for Thursday, May 4th, 2017.
I'm Susan Wilson, I'm the Programming Manager for the Clark County Public Works Department. And one of the things that we do each year is we update our Transportation Improvement Program, which is a six-year program. We also update our Annual Construction Program, which is the first year of the Transportation Improvement Program. So this year, what we're doing is we're updating our evaluation system. It was a bit outdated. And so we're meeting with the Development Engineering Advisory Board, NAC, and the Regional Transportation Advisory Council to get input to try to validate our ranking system, just to make sure we're not missing these things. So what we're hoping for is to kind of go through the evaluation system with you guys to see if there's anything else that we can be doing to appropriately prioritize our transportation improvement projects. So we'll be talking about the guiding principles, legalities of the program, the evaluation goals, and then the ranking details. So our guiding principles set by our Board of County Councilors is we have to pay our debt service. It's the first thing we do, and then we look at all of our safety projects, and then we move to preserving what we have, our assets such as bridges, sidewalks, culverts. And then after that, we look at our capital projects. Our capital projects are consistent with our 20-year CFP. So all of our capital projects must be in our adopted TIP and our annual construction program, which is the first year of the TIP. We have to have a priority programming. The TIP is a state-mandated program adopted by the council on an annual basis before the budget's adopted. And then we follow the policies of the comprehensive plan via the 20-year CFP. So what we have for our evaluation system is we have nine categories, and then within, four categories and nine. So most of the largest percentage of our evaluation system is safety, followed by economic development and mobility. Then we also look at other features such as environmental impacts, agency support, and leveraging of funding. So Michael's going to go into detail about the evaluation system and all of our updates that we had completed this year.
Okay, so thank you. The ranking criteria that we use to prioritize projects is we strive to make it objective, database, and leverage some of the best practices that we can find within the industry and within government. We have a lot of different criteria that you see here. It's a 100-point weighted scoring system that lets us weight project that lets us use a descending score to help prioritize which projects we advance forward to design, planning, and construction each year. Diving a little bit deeper into these nine items to familiarize you a little bit more. As Susan said, safety is the county's highest priority, given most points of all TIP ranking categories. There are two different parts to this ranking criteria. Recent change this year that we're implementing, performance score uses statistical methods that are recommended in the manual for HSM. That's a national publication by the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, other commonly known as ASHTO, and FHA. The HSM provides a data-driven statistical way to look not only at crash frequency, but severity, the type of crashes, and contributing factors, which allows us to take a more comprehensive look at potential safety benefits than our previous methods, which just simply count the number of collisions. After the performance score, we take a look at risk exposure, which takes a look at some of the current roads' substandard conditions that the potential project would be intended to address. And those two categories together totals 30 points out of the 100 that make up the entire ranking system. The second highest point category in the TIP is economic development. That is worth 20 points, as Susan mentioned, in recognition of its importance to county councilors and job growth to the county as a whole. This ties in very closely with the vacant buildable lands model and some of the concepts we use to comply with the Growth Management Act, our capital facilities plan, and other legally required long-range plans that Susan mentioned in the earlier slide. We follow the same methodology as the vacant buildable lands model, assigning points to industrial and commercial jobs based on a sliding scale. We then rank the TIP projects in the order of jobs created, and then roughly divide them into five different bins, assigning points on a sliding scale. The goal is for at least the top 20% of projects to get the maximum points in each category, but that can be adjusted for natural breaks. The other portion of economic development is to take a look at development potential. And here, this year, we've also added a couple of new items that were suggested by the Columbia River Economic Development Council. We continue to award points for being in a Board of Councilors designated focused public investment area, but we actually reduced the number of points for being in one of those focused public areas so that we could include additional points and additional consideration of sites that the CREDC has identified as development ready, that could be ready for an employer, ready to generate jobs and tax base within, say, 2 to 3 years, and also for proximity to state highways and interchanges, which according to CREDC is very important to many employers. Moving right along, unless there are questions, if there are, feel free to shout them out. The next category is, how does the current roadway compare to what the road should look like according to the county's arterial atlas? We award points if the current roadway, to bring it up to standard, requires additional travel lanes, if it requires a center or left turn lane, if sidewalks are not currently present, and if bike lanes are needed to bring the current road up to arterial standard as part of the project. We look at concurrency, another big area, to ensure that the roads are ready by the time the development traffic is ready for them. Here we've made a slight change. We are now looking at volume to capacity ratio when we're scoring a roadway segment from point A to point B, because our county concurrency experts tell us that volume to capacity is a more appropriate measure for a through street, or how many cars can a road carry in those lanes before congestion slows everyone down. For intersections, we continue to use a level of service measure because, according to the concurrency staff, level of service measures the delay that motorists see as they're waiting at an intersection for the light that seemingly never changes. So small tweak there, but otherwise, we continue to take a look at factors, including will the proposed project include an intersection of regional significance, which is defined as an intersection where at least three of the four lanes are classified as collectors or arterials within the arterial atlas and county code. We take a look at whether the road would include a concurrency corridor. We take a look at whether the proposed project is likely to improve congestion in an area that has been designated a moratorium area, or whether the project is likely to improve transportation in an urban holding area. So those are the four factors we look at under the heading concurrency to attempt to evaluate the benefit of a potential project. Moving on, the next factor we look at is route connectivity, or how does the project link to other arterial and collector routes in the arterial atlas, the goal being to create circulation get into all the neighborhoods and to the arterials and large urban centers and vice versa. So we actually prefer, in this case, road projects that link to both arterials and collectors to create that cross-circulation. And you probably know what arterials and collectors are in this group, so unless there's questions, we can move on to multimodal aspects that are becoming more important for us. We would like projects that improve access to multimodal facilities, so we look at various features again that are missing and would be provided by a new project. If a proposed project would improve a defined bicycle route according to regional trail and local systems plans or Clark County bicycle maps that promote cycling, will the project improve access to one of C-TRAN's many parking rides? Is it actually on a C-TRAN route? And finally, would the project improve access to one of Clark County's trail or trailheads? Environmental was a category that basically got completely blown up and started over with. It used to be much simpler, but our environmental services staff, when we asked them to look at what current state of the art is, took a look at what we were doing and proposed the matrix you see here instead of the relatively simple three or four questions we used to be looking at. The environmental services staff has defined categories that are specified in the written write-up but are omitted from this slide. But generally speaking, they'll take a look at one of the concerns such as the difficulty in getting a NEPA SEPA permit, or the size of the environmental impact the project is likely to create. And then, based on specific factors that they developed for us and they evaluate for us, the project is ranked as either low or no impact, getting 0.75 points per concern, moderate impact, which is worth 0.4, or perhaps a given permit or situation has high likelihood of complication, in which case it gets 0 points. So that projects with a higher cost benefit or lesser environmental impact are pushed a little bit toward the top. Let's see. Okay, so I saw a hand waving for a question. Moving on, approximately, slide. About 50% of our transportation program, or about $15 million per year that we have available for projects, comes from outside sources. So funding leverage is extremely important to programming in public works. So we definitely take a look at what non-county funds are awarded or committed to the project. And award points on the sliding scale you see here, the non-county funds could be, and it's often state or federal grants, but we also take a look at regional fees, developer fees, and other outside money that has been committed to help us with the project. And finally, we look at public and other support. Is there any other formal support for a project out there? That again helps us justify a project and perhaps leverage other work that's been completed. Is it on a regional transportation plan, a state TIP, or perhaps a surrounding city's transportation plan? Is there formal public support in terms of an officially adopted neighborhood circulation plan or other documents that would support this project? And we want to recognize those cooperative relationships. So again, folks are present, we give them a point or two in recognition of that cooperation. And those are the categories that we take a look at. So Susan is back to consolidate things and wrap up a little bit and summarize.
You guys have any questions, concerns about?
I do have a question. I want to wait till the end to see if you covered it, but when it comes to the jobs creation, has anybody talked about consideration for the income of the job? So if it's 100 jobs at minimum wage or 100 jobs at 100 grand, is that something that was taken into consideration?
It is not currently taken into consideration, but that came up in another presentation we did.
It's actually done to commercial and industrial. So if we look at the, so you have potential industrial job and then commercial jobs, but talking about actual wages, we don't take into consideration, but industrial jobs do typically have higher wages. That's the reason why we assign work points to that. So I mean, so in general.
It is, but it's not.
Yeah, it's not a detailed analysis.
On that same point, nine jobs per net buildable acres. You're talking about jobs within the county itself?
Yes.
You don't count trips across the river then?
I don't believe so, because we're taking a look at the jobs that are, if this comes from the vacant buildable land model, and the way they come up with those numbers is to take a look at the vacant buildable lands in the county. Is it zoned industrial or commercial? And for an acre of land in the county that's zoned industrial, they apply a factor of nine jobs per acre. So the answer to that, I believe, would be no. We're only looking at front county jobs based on the acres that we have available here.
Are we meeting that goal?
Of
nine jobs per acre.
It's not, my understanding is it's not necessarily a goal, but a quick interesting story on how those numbers were defined. Back during an earlier iteration of the growth management plan, the county did an actual study over a five-year period in the late 90s to early 2000s of issued building permits for these types of projects and how many jobs were actually created versus promised. And in that five-year look back on actual building permits, they determined that for an industrial building permit that was issued, the county was averaging nine jobs. And likewise for commercial, it was 20 jobs averaged when a commercial parcel developed. So those were the numbers that the county started applying to various planning documents that are required. For consistency, we carry that forward into this program. So it's based on the actual results, and I was actually quite surprised to hear that we've gone to that level of taking a look at what actually transpired versus promises that were made to get a permit. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Asset condition index, pavement condition index. Asset condition index or pavement condition index, are they factored into your criteria?
Not at present. Asset condition.
Sorry, what is the existing condition of the assets? If you have two projects roughly competitive scoring, asset condition index.
Actually, let me back off on that statement. It is kind of looked at under the risk exposure portion of safety if there's a lot of fixed objects next to the road that create a hazard, if there's very narrow shoulder widths, if the roadside drop-offs are extreme. Basically, if the road isn't up to current standards and is kind of, as the bridge term would be, functionally obsolete, it's kind of alluded to in the risk exposure score.
So what level of objectivity is coming into that if you have two competing projects with roughly the same scores? How are you going to say one over the other?
Well, most of our CSP projects, if you look at the evaluation, you know, for one thing, they're all good projects.
Yeah.
They are. Some of them are within decimal of each other.
Yeah.
So what happens is this is a really high-level planning, prioritizing our capital facilities projects. You know, so we have some justification of when we build them. So we take the top tier of projects, which may be 5 or 10 projects, and then we say, okay, these are within points, within decimal, whatever the case may be, because they're all good projects, but I have a funding opportunity for project number 5 as opposed to project number 4. Of course, we're gonna go for that funding opportunity.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of just judgment calls in that aspect. Did I answer that question?
Yeah, I know where you're coming from.
The TIF provides the hard number analysis jumping off point for further analysis, where we bring in some of the other more subjective factors like Susan was mentioning. So if you're beat out by a tenth of a point, it doesn't mean that
So my next question is, have you taken this model for a drive, test drive, to see when the results come out using the scoring system, does it look right? Because normally when you develop prioritisation methodology, you will run a few example projects through it, test it and say, wow, you know, we're pretty much online with what everyone is thinking is correct. Versus, wow, we're getting at something which is totally bizarre, and have we got the right scoring criteria in play?
Well, the scoring criteria hasn't changed a whole lot in the past 10 okay. years, and there's, I mean, I don't know how many engineers have looked at this, to be honest with you, you know, we have a team at multiple disciplines, and mm-hmm. so I believe we are, I mean, consistent with the CFP, that's high-level modeling. We get, you know, more micro-level modeling that we do on these projects. So I do believe we are building what we need to build in our
Okay, but you haven't test-driven this model since you revised it.
That we're meeting with our stakeholders now, like you guys, and then we met with Steve and a bunch of other groups, and just to see if we're missing anything. And there's a couple recommendations, a couple tweaks we'll do based upon our stakeholder meetings.
And we do take a look at the prioritized ranking when we do flush all the projects through the system. I think we do a little of what you're suggesting, perhaps not to the degree of formality, but we do take a look at the projects ranked, and if a particular project we think should have ranked a lot higher doesn't, or vice versa, if something doesn't appear to pass the smell test, It is looked at further, because the ranking is just a jumping off point for helping us to make an intelligent decision. It's not a numeric be all end all.
No, you just answered my question.
Yeah, so I'll go through all the projects. We'll both go through all the projects. If someone doesn't pass the sniff test, of course we're going to do further research.
No, that's fine.
For this program and what they're showing today, they have approached a lot of different disciplines to come up with kind of the ranking criteria. Concurrency being one of those, that's me. But as they were trying to kind of revamp their prioritization list, they came to us with, because they haven't changed this program for several years, and concurrency and other programs have changed over time. Now we've got some different thresholds that we can use to evaluate against other projects in the county that are a little bit more specific, a little bit more detail oriented, the volume, the capacity, and the level of service stuff. As far as what they're showing today, at least for my stuff, those are items that are tested and true for concurrency. So those are the things that I look at regularly in traffic studies and current development as I'm doing my evaluation against that stuff. So on a larger level, they've taken what I look at on a daily basis and are now applying it at a planning level step to evaluate and help them rank the different projects that they have in their list.
Yeah. I don't have any concerns with the criteria in that. It's just that I spend probably 50% of my time doing project evaluations and ranking systems. And when you get projects coming very close to each other,
sure,
things like the asset condition index or the facility condition index or the pavement condition index is a good way of just sort of saying, hey, there's an objective way as why this one should rise up. The other thing is that decision-making models like this, there are hundreds and hundreds of different ways you can do it. They're all open to conjecture.
Sure.
And sometimes you can go forth with a model thinking it works, but until you actually sit down and say, here's 20 projects, let's just do a draft run through, yet that looks right, then you have greater confidence in going forward with that model when you've got a couple of hundred or a thousand. That's all I'm suggesting.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And this is really a, more of a high-level analysis.
Yeah, I normally work off 5 criteria and then thin the bag down, then drop into another 15 and work it through.
And I think where our confidence lands is, like the highway safety standard, that's the industry standard. You know, working with David Jardine on some of his model that's consistent with our council model, meeting with CRDC, meeting with environmental scientists, I mean, that really gives us confidence that we are evaluating what we need to evaluate with these projects.
That being said, as Susan mentioned a couple of times, they're all good projects that often finish within, you know, decimal points of each other. So, you know, what comes out of the TIP ranking is a starting point for, you know, discussions, what's most needed, what has the most funding. You know, if this is the objective data points that help us then make better subjective decisions. Yes, sir.
Just wondering about the scope of your program, how many projects you have competing and ranking, and what kind of dollars.
After good question. After we added the new projects that were added to the capital facilities plan this year, I believe we are ranking approximately between 24 and 30 projects. I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact number.
Under your funding leverage, give me an example of grants. That's the first part. Second part, what's the mode on the percentages?
The example of a good grant would be a state bicycle and pedestrian grant that we would use to build a sidewalk, or a state, a federal grant for roads through the MAP 21 program, standard federal road construction grant. Variety of sources. We also get a lot of grants from the Transportation Improvement Board for roadways. Those are probably the main ones. And as far as the funding breakdown, we just approximated as you see. There's really not a whole lot of logic to it other than the more funding leverage there is, the easier it is for us to build a project. Remembering that this is one factor out of 9, so even a project that had 80% funding leverage might still be behind other projects in terms of going into construction.
Of those percentages, though, which one's the most common?
The most common funding we have is federal Fed Aid money and then Transportation Improvement Board money. In an ideal world, you know, state can match federal can match state. Some state can match some state, federal cannot match federal. But if you bring in like a some traffic impact fees, some state money, some federal money, especially for larger projects, like 119th Street corridor, we could not have done it without our funding partners. I mean, there's no way. And so
the question you asked specifically, I think, is a little more difficult, but I'm gonna ballpark it. Maybe you can chime in, Susan. Mm-hmm. I suspect that between 20 and 40% of the quote-unquote typical project might be grant funded. If it's a smaller sidewalk project, I'm dealing with a couple right now that are 50 to 80% grant funded. On a larger project, like Susan's mentioning, like 119th Street, that's, you know, 10, 15, 20 million, it might be a much lower percentage.
The reason why I was asking all that is that dealing with WASDOT and their 20-year plan, very little of that money is coming south. Mm. Very little of it. Most of it's staying up in the three counties up Clark and Snohomish and Pierce.
Mm-hmm. Looking at this safety slide, you've got a 20-point score and a 10-point score.
Right.
Is that 0 or 20? You either get it all or you get nothing?
No, it's floating. The performance score is one number, so that could range from 5 to 20 points. and risk exposure, again, is floating. It's up to a maximum of 10 points.
Okay.
There's a lot of different ways to get there.
So the description that you have on the following slide, economic development, where you go 0 to 7,
yes,
that appears to be more in line with what you're actually describing for the safety slide. So rather,
yes,
than say it's 20 or nothing.
Yes, that is true.
So for the safety score, you're going to get a higher score for fatal fatalities and a higher score for injury accidents, and then property damage accidents, a lower score.
Yeah.
So it is a sliding, it's a sliding score, but also it's also based upon a percentile. Correct me if I'm wrong, Michael. So we throw out the higher scores, we throw out the lower scores, so we can have more of a curve. So we don't have the projects that just pop up and get all the points. You see what I'm saying? So it's more on a percentile.
Right. So that's kind of like how you work inside. All I'm saying is, when we go to the hearing, I'd like to see you describe it as you're actually awarding the points.
Okay, to have a min and a max value for each criteria.
So it's clear about how much is really going to be awarded in that regard.
Okay.
All right. And I wanted to clarify, I think in economic development, the work we've been doing in the past, from a planning commission standpoint, I think we put a lot of emphasis on trying to get development around state highways and interchanges. I see that you're only awarding 1 point.
Mm-hmm.
Would you have an internal discussion about that and see if that's the way you want to continue? I think from all the work we've done to try and zone around that, the opportunity to go higher on that, I think, would be something that we would consider worth the time and effort we put in. And looking at the comparison to the arterial atlas, the way I'm reading this, it says, if you really require a center or a left-hand turn lane, you get more points, as opposed to if the facility already has a center or left-hand turn lane?
That is correct. If you do not, if the current road is, for instance, a two-lane, built to a two-lane rural standard with no center lane, but the Clark County Atlas says, when you rebuild it, the current standard for this road calls for say two lanes plus a center turn, then you get the 0.4 plus a center turn.
So if the standard is higher to achieve, it's going to cost us more money to put it in. We're giving it more points because we're upgrading the condition of the road to the Atlas from
if the road is missing functionality that it needs to serve today's needs, then we recognize the road is deficient by giving it a couple points to make it a little bit higher priority versus a road that already has the necessary features and maybe only needs a pavement job, which wouldn't be a capital program anyway that I digress.
So we typically do that. However, when we get down to the design and, sometimes we deviate some of this stuff, just depending upon what we do here. But for the high level programming, the priority array.
Cool.
Yes, we do give points for things that are consistent with our arterial atlas.
Okay, but it's rare to have a project that's going to require a center or a left-hand turn lane where you're not also required to put in sidewalks, right?
Correct.
I mean, 119.
So this is like if you get one, you ring the bell, you got 3 or 4 extra points here.
Rural would be different. Rural versus urban, you wouldn't be.
These are all urban.
Even though both might have a center turn lane, you wouldn't necessarily have sidewalks in the borough.
Right.
So it doesn't go together always.
Although the idea that we're spending our money on rural roads seems less likely when we start looking at all the point structure.
This evaluation is urban only.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, it's urban only. And there are projects that they may have sidewalk.
Already?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Awesome. But they probably have a center turn lane too.
Perhaps.
Yeah. Okay. That's all I got.
So another thing I wanted to ask you guys about, what do you guys think about a cost-benefit analysis? I mean,
we kind of
do one on the environmental by doing all the permitting. We do some with safety, but I mean, what do you think about a cost-benefit analysis?
What are you weighing the benefits as? Is it strictly economic?
No, it's just through everything.
It's everything.
The project costs a lot of money. We often have challenges and we struggle with funding everything that needs to be funded.
You mean instead of funding one large project, you fund maybe 9 small ones?
Perhaps.
Yeah.
More and more partnerships.
The one comment I'd make on that is that it sometimes becomes a lot of work. There's a lot of intangibles, and trying to translate some of those intangibles into a money value is not easy and opens the door to a lot of conjecture. If you were to include it, what you might want to look at it is saying if there's 5 criteria at the moment, you have a 6th criteria, return on investment, cost-benefit analysis. If that is not available or not achievable, you still score on the other one. So you look at it as a value add or a confirmation of what you've got.
Mm-hmm.
But just a word of warning, it is a lot of work. I do ask for myself, and that's one reason why I probably caution you going down that line. The other thing I was just thinking of is, and I'm not suggesting you do this now, but it might be worth your while doing some research into benefits realisation and looking at projects from a benefits-based approach. So you actually come back to the city, the county council and that, and talk about the projects in terms of the extent of benefits being realised from the project, as opposed to sort of looking at sort of the more mechanics of the projects. But again, that's there for something to research and do. You wouldn't be able to make the move overnight.
So go to tab number 4, and we're going to talk about Scrivener errors.
Scrivener errors.
Very exciting stuff.
What was that 4 you said?
4.
Tab 4. So about a year ago, while we were crunching down to our comp plan deadlines, we put together this monster. Okay? And when we did that, we missed some stuff. And that's what tab number 4 is all about. I'm just going to quickly walk you through some of the things that we found, and hope it makes some sense to you. So in chapter number 1, the land use chapter, there's a comp plan designation to zone matrix, and we forgot to include rural 5. Everything in yellow is something that is broken. In the second table, we forgot to include part of open space. And I should mention that these are text inaccuracies. The zoning map and the comp plan map are correct. It's just this document, okay? And in the urban table, it's supposed to be R-43, so 40. We forgot our hyphens. One of our goals in the environmental chapter, it said conversation instead of conservation. Okay, spelled
messy. Someone threatened to appeal our critical areas ordinance update on account of that.
Who would that be?
You're the kid.
I told him to go right ahead.
Yeah, but things happen.
Well, I should say consultation, rather than conversation, so.
We're having a conversation.
Thank you for whatever it's worth.
Let's do both.
Then in chapter 14, the procedural section, there used to be a whole laundry list of tests. As it described, how do you lift urban holding and where those areas were and what it was going to take to lift it? Did you need to do a transportation analysis? Did you need to find money? There was a laundry list of things. But we had satisfied quite a bit of that since the 07 plan. But as we were doing the cross outs and collapsing, we actually deleted the wrong section and now we're putting it back. So that's what this is all about. And as I said, the maps are correct. It's just this part. So don't ask me how we did that. I have no clue. And so that's the first, in the very back of the comp plan, in the appendix B, we list all the figures of all the different maps we have back there. And we forgot to keep it.
Very well.
Yeah.
That
map's been in existence since 1993. It's just messed up. So that's the first of two staff reports. And I guess the question I have for you is, any questions?
All right, keep rolling.
The second staff report is an idea that we've been kicking around for quite some time, and we thought this would be a good time to bring it forward. And that is, back in roughly 2005 or so, the board made a decision that if we were going to take a look at the creating of a rural center, and you had property owners who were interested in doing the analysis of that, that it would go from a docket where the county would pay for it and do all the analysis to an annual review. Then the financial burden and the analysis would be on the applicant, okay? So that was done in 2005. And we've been noodling it. We'd like to put it back the way it was. Staff believes that it should be a docket. There's quite a bit of technical information and expense that it's very difficult for the property owners to do, especially when you're looking at holistic, broader scale, because we need to look at a comp plan area much larger than the particular properties that they're putting forward. So what this does is put the text back in both the comp plan text and in the associated Title 40 Unified Development Code to move it from an annual review back to a docket process. I don't have to confuse you, but there's the text for the comp plan text itself, and then this is what we will change in the final version. And basically, it's an internal process. But what this does, it saves the community a lot of time, anguish, and dollars.
A creation? You're asking that a landowner can come in and create a rural center?
They can ask that we consider the creation of a new rural center, but the way the process is now is an annual review.
I understand that, but I think that is opening up to a lot of misunderstanding about the potential of it happening.
That has been in the comp plan now for quite a long time.
As a docket.
As an annual review.
Right, I understand that. And I think that threshold prevents people from just rolling the dice and saying, you know what, I think I should be a rural center. And we're going to put the burden on us. And when they find out that they don't meet the criteria, they're going to be really disappointed.
No, I think you're right. However, if you look at the creation of the existing rural centers, that was done at no cost to the property owners.
That was the very, very first time, though. And we established the boundaries at that moment.
Yes. Now, if someone or a couple of property owners were to approach the county and said, hey, take a look at Duluth area, for example. We think it meets the criteria to be designated as a rural center. What we are saying is that that effort should be undertaken by the county, just very similar the same way we took the effort to designate the ward that we currently have. We have to still, rather than putting that burden on the property owner to go find whether it, go hire a lawyer, for example, to go find out whether you meet the GMA criteria, that burden is going to be on the county. We can review it, look at the statute, look at the area, do the analysis, come back to you, the planning commission, and say yes or no. We have reviewed this, it meets the criteria, it doesn't meet the criteria, excuse me. You review that, you make a recommendation to the council. Why put that burden on the property owners to go do that analysis, or maybe hire a land use attorney to help them go do that? So the way we used to do it in the past is it became a county initiated action to do that analysis, to review it, and come back through your own type 4 process and public hearing and determine whether it should be designated as a rural center or not.
So if the county assumes that responsibility, what's the sort of likely impact on resources, both on staff time and financial resources?
It is because what happens is that when we receive that request, we go back to our council and let them know that we receive such a request. Should we proceed or not? Should we put it as part of our work program? So they make that call. They will fund it, in a sense.
Okay, so let's just say it was $150,000 for the sake of conversation. If the county said, no, we haven't got that, or we don't think that $150,000 is well spent on that, what happens then afterwards from the property owners?
The council, why I cannot speak for them, they can make two recommendations. One is we take it on,
yeah,
because it has to be done through once a year. Opening up the comp plan, or what I said earlier, they can put it on our work program, have it be done during the large periodic review of the comp plan, for example. So all that cost is absorbed at that time. So they have two ways of doing so.
Or they could say no, we're not interested, you have to wait a year. Or
and if they said no, the applicant, do they have any recourse? Can they force anything?
You know, some of this, as you know, sir, is not guaranteed.
No, I know.
Yeah, so we can say yes. Putting it on the docket doesn't mean approval.
Yeah.
But at least the property owners are treated the same way others were treated in the past. Nothing. That's really the rationale. Why have them pay exorbitant fees or go through that process and still get the same answer? Unless, you know, we have looked at so many areas that could have been designated as a rural center by the work that Gordy did in the early 90s. There were about 20 or 25 sites that were identified as potential rural centers because of their character. Now, there is nothing that will stop the county from revisiting those areas, for example. So we had some areas that we can take another look at to see whether they qualify. You know, and I think if we miss something, if the task force that looked at that missed something, this putting it on the docket would create another opportunity for county staff and the county to revisit some of the same similar issues and maybe reach the same conclusion that they didn't meet the criteria to be a rural center or not. The expansion is more difficult, but we've done it in the past in terms of expanding existing rural centers. It's not easy. It requires some, I believe, 60% of the property owners all agreed to see their areas expanded. You know, I always say this, nothing is written in stone. The rural centers are supposed to be recognized to what they were, say, when the growth plan or the GMA was passed in 1990. So when you ask for expansion, you gotta be careful in the way you're reviewing it. Are you expanding the area to some of the areas that weren't defined or looked like a rural center in 1990? So expansion is not that easy, but creating a new one is the same way. You have to look at the area. Does it have the characteristics of a rural center? Some folks have approached us, some of you are familiar with the Duluth area, that it should have been a rural center, but that's, if you look at Duluth, it's just, whatever is there is just for the traveling public, if you will. It's not similar as you will find in Dollar Square, for example, where you have what you may call a community, or even in Rushbury or Meadowland, where you have a church, a store, and other things that make it look like a village, if you will. Things like just for a traveling public won't qualify. That's why Duluth haven't been recognized as a rural center, for example.
With all due respect, Oliver, I'm just anticipating the moment you do this, those same aggrieved parties in Duluth are going to again come forward because they still live in the same place and they wanted to be a rural center 25 years ago. And we're going to have to completely revisit and come up with justification to defend our reasoning 25 years ago with more staff time and an understanding of why things aren't different when they're going to have 25 years of saying this should have been the whole time. And I guess we went to a lot of trouble to decide which ones were and which ones weren't then. And we've withstood all of the requests in the past that didn't have legitimacy. We have expanded in Hawkinson. We did expand in Meadowglade. We went across the highway.
Chalachie Prairie.
Chalachie Prairie as well, thank you. I think basically we're going to have to anticipate this is going to be staff time and this is going to be rigidly adhered to in a fashion that's going to cause us a lot of work and people, they're going to come back. So I honestly don't understand our motivation. If there's probably something unspoken about why we're choosing to do this, and I just don't get it.
I don't disagree, but I still believe that A, the statute provides for providing opportunity for property owners A, to make site-specific requests, which comes before you through the annual review process. The statute also provides for a docket process whereby you can take some of this as a county-initiated action and review them. Is again, I say I will submit to you that it's not guaranteed. There have been docket requests that we've looked at and recommended denial, and you agree with staff based on the analysis. If I don't think that making it annual review prohibits the county from doing the same analysis, but I think, you know, the rationale for putting it as an annual review in the past was that, A, you're not getting one single property, you're getting like 10 or 20, so they can afford to pay. That was the rationale at the time. Well, if you look at what we did in the past, those that we designated, we didn't ask them to pay. Someone can make that same argument. Well, you did this in the past, we didn't pay. Why are you asking us, you property owners coming out to pay? So you can weigh it either way. I think that making it an annual review provides that opportunity for the county to take that initiative as we've done in the past to review whatever the council asks us to do. Yes, would it be more, get more resources? Yes, but, you know, if you take a look at it and say that, hey, it should remain at annual review, that's going to be your recommendation to the council. We believe it should be adopted.
I just wanted to just say, it looks like maybe the thinking behind it is maybe we want to have the opportunity brought forth to be able to look at these opportunities to create these rural centers, because I know back in the 80s when they created this, they wanted these type of rural centers. It was the 80s, wasn't it?
94.
94. Okay. So they created these opportunities. They want to be able to create these nodes out there in the county. Now that we put the burden on the people to have the money to be able to, they can't afford to do it. Nothing's being brought forward, I would imagine. Nobody's shelling out $150,000 to try to get it done. But if we can do it internally, it gives us the opportunity to take a look at it and say, is this a benefit? There's a cost benefit here. And right off the bat, in my opinion, if you bring it to the council, and the council says, yes, I want to put this on the docket, or no, I don't. At that time, if the people say, no, I want this on the docket, we're going to hire an attorney, we're going to figure out how we're going to make this happen, well, then they'll spend their $150,000 to try to, you know what I mean? Is that long?
Can it still be put on the docket and you can say no?
Oh, yeah, you can put it on the docket and you say no. That's totally up to the county council. But I like the idea that we're at least looking at the opportunity right off the top. I like that. It creates opportunities. You can always say no, but I think it creates opportunities.
Well, we'll hear it, and I'm so sorry, but it appears like I have run us right out of time. Don't we have a hearing?
No.
Oh, God. All right, well, let's keep talking about it then.
This is the last item that I have for you, so I'm done.
Oh.
Unless you got questions.
Sorry. We got all the time in the world now.
Well, no, now it gets to be fun.
What's that?
Nothing. Yeah, Gordy.
Small.
He didn't like the way he wrote the S on the Scrivener, so he wants to talk about that.
Okay, I'm going to tag team with Gordy here on this one. You have a hearing May 18th, and what we have here is an update on what we, the county, is doing, or the council have directed us to do to try to come in compliance with the ruling of the Growth Management Hearings Board. So if we can go to the next slide, Gordy.
Do they know about the emergency ordinance?
We'll talk about
that.
So,
oh, by the way.
Don't be a spoiler.
Following the adoption of the 2016 plan update, the county plan was challenged by Clark County Citizens United and FutureWise and Friends of Clark County.
This is not in your binder.
This is not in your binder. What is in your binder is the staff report, which probably needs to be updated or whatever, but the growth board, after the appeal, the growth board had a hearing in February of last year, or this year, and on March 23rd issued their final decision and order, and there were about 25 issues that were decided on. One issue was withdrawn, and that issue was from Clark County Citizens United on the fact that we did not conduct a SEPA review.
No, the issue that they withdrew was about remainder parcels that were
that we brought in remainder parcel into the UGB. Anyway, the withdrawal, that case was withdrawn. So and Chris is going to help me out here. Clark County, of the remaining 24 issues, Clark County won on 18 issues.
Well, actually, there was another issue that had been decided and dismissed prior to the final decision and order coming out, and that was one on the timing of the rural industrial land bank. So,
okay. And we had, following the road board ruling, we had until April 24th to file an appeal. That's 30 days from their ruling. And we also have 180 days to come in compliance. That will be September 19th. And our compliance hearing will be on November 7th, 2017.
So, Oliver, does that mean that there's not going to be any sanctions, monetary sanctions, refusals to approve grant agreements and so forth during that 180-day compliance period?
No, that's not what it means.
That's a shame. That's what it should mean.
Well, it says no. The state law and administrative code say you have to be in compliance, and the growth board has ruled that the county is not in compliance. So the idea, I believe, is so that counties do things correctly to begin with and not take flyers at, well, we should try this and see if the growth board will buy it. So anyway, as of now, the county is, the growth board has ruled that the county is not in compliance with GMA.
And the reason we're having the hearing in 2 weeks is we have proposed some things that the county decided not to appeal, so we're bringing those changes to you, which we're going to get to. That's the purpose of the meeting. What you're hearing now is just the background of how we got to right now.
So they go back to the growth board versus going to Superior Court. Is that what you're saying?
The growth board has, in the state statute, it has a 6-month period within which the county is supposed to come into compliance as defined by the growth board. So the growth board could have told us to come into compliance in 2 months or 3 months. They gave us the maximum 6 months, and yeah, we go back to the growth board to determine compliance. What's interesting is that at the same time, so concurrently when we're dealing with compliance, we also have an appeal before Superior Court. So it's being looked at by two different decision-making bodies. And as I say, that just makes it inefficient and odd. But because there's no particular time within which Superior Court has to rule, the growth board does not necessarily look favorably upon a county coming to it and saying, well, you should just stay this non-compliance decision while we're appealing, because, you know, we may overturn what you said. If that makes sense.
So I just want to make sure I'm getting up to speed here. So we have 180 days to get within compliance.
Well, we have until September 19th at this point.
Yes. But in the meantime, they're not going to approve grants like that until we get into compliance?
That's a good question. It's not 100% decided.
Okay. And we're also in Superior Court?
Yes.
Right. Certain items.
Because certain items, right. we're taking that.
Yeah. Some things that they said you were wrong about, we said no, we're not.
We said no, we're not. We're waiting for that.
There are a total of 6 appeals to Superior Court. So Clark County appealed, City of Ridgefield appealed, City of LaCenter appealed, the landowners in Ridgefield appealed, the landowners in LaCenter appealed, and Clark County Citizens United, which lost every single one of its issues, also appealed.
Every single one in yours.
Yes.
Does that go to
Cowlitz
County?
No, that does not go to Cowlitz County. The choices are for GMA appeals are Clark County or Thurston County.
And if I heard you right, you said severe. You don't know how long they're going to be.
No, that's no. They do not have a timeline.
Okay.
No,
so we're
going to
get to it.
Yeah. So if 7 years is too long, that's how long it took the county to come in compliance with the 2007 plan adoption. I'm not anticipating that it would take us 7 years, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Here are the non-compliance issues that we are going to be trying to find a way to deal with. The first one is the UGA expansions of Battleground, Richfield, and the center, and our buildable lands report. They tie that together because of the need issue. You know, you all went through the hearing. The county accepted the expansion or granted the expansion in Richfield that included 100 acres. Plus that was designated as agriculture, but since that property had been annexed. Similarly, in the center, about 52 acres, also designated as agriculture, that have been annexed. In the case of Battleground, it's only about 80 acres. Which was not annexed.
Right.
The other issue that the growth board said our action is not in compliance, it's the urban reserve overlay. This one gets really confusing. What we tried to do, which we came and presented to you, was to have a true urban reserve overlay. And the issue here is that we really maintain the uses that are currently permitted in or have been in allowed in urban reserve areas, and we were appealed that we were allowing certain urban uses in a rural area. The other issue, as I mentioned, was the ag designation in Butler Center and Richfield was found to be in non-compliance, and Chris can touch on this issue because it is the major issue that the growth board issued an order of invalidity.
No.
The
order of invalidity was on the top
expansion.
One,
the expansion
expansions, when it said that our buildable lands report did not reflect a need for expansion.
Okay, that was the need analysis.
Yeah.
Sorry. And then that upzoning of ag and forest from 20 to 10 and forest 40 to 20 was also in non-compliance. They argue that the county having one rural designation rather than multiple rural designation is also in non-compliance, and that there was a procedural error in the rural industrial land bank designation. What they're really saying there is that we did not have or show in our development regulation the maximum areas that should be for rural industrial land.
We set a minimum in code. But
we set a minimum, but not maximum.
Which is what GMA requires, obviously.
Yeah. And finally, the de-designation of the 600 plus acres of the rural industrial land bank. So those are the areas that the growth board ruled that were in non-compliance with the statute. I will turn it over to Gordy to, well, what is it that we are appealing? We are appealing, in terms of what we have appealed to the Clark County Superior Court, we are appealing the UGE expansion and the ruling on the buildable lands report, as well as the designation of the rural, our rural industrial land bank designation and the designation of ag. So those are the two issues that we're appealing to the Clark County Superior Court.
And so, just so you're clear, we're appealing the growth board's ruling that those, that are, the county's actions with respect to those things violated GMA.
Right.
And with respect to the buildable lands report, we're also complaining about the order of invalidity. The cities and the landowners have also appealed. Well, we're also appealing the de-designation, the ruling on the de-designation for the city expansions. So it's actually three issues.
Three issues, okay.
And then we're also appealing the order on de-designation of the Rural Industrial Land Bank. That landowner is not appealing. Was quoted, his lawyer was quoted in the paper saying something like, well, the county's doing it, so we don't need to.
There you go. United Front.
So we have four of these
major lots.
We put $100,000 in the project. It seemed like a. Where others would have to feel bad. We do have a bit of investment. So that brings,
I'll turn it over to you.
That brings us to what you guys need to hear about. This is in the state report. So these are the things that we're proposing to do, that we're getting on, we're getting on with the process in terms of coming into compliance. So without going into all the details, the actual ordinance language for some of these are in the staff report. It's 23 pages, but I'm just going to give you the highlights. We're changing any reference to Ag 10 back to Ag 20. And any reference to Forest 20 back to Forest 40 and eliminating the clustering provision. That was a new section that we put in the resource designation part of the code to allow, we originally started out saying clustering you had to do, which we thought gave us a fighting chance of winning the hearing board approval, but when the board made it optional, that nixed it, in my opinion. One of the things we did, because we had some Rule 20 and Rule 10 that was part of another remand settlement, because we were going to, which is we used buffer lands between rural, smaller rural parcels and resource land, we actually rezoned some parcels from 20 R20 to R10. They're about, I think their list I saw had about 280 parcels. We're going to put those back as well. Back from R10 to R20. That part was not challenged, but in our minds, these two things go together. So, and in the adoption ordinance, the list of these things will be typed out. As Oliver said, we were dinged for only having one rural designation, even though we implemented with three zones, R5, R10, R20. So you'll see language in there that we're going to have three comp plan rural designations, R5, R10, R20, each implemented with its own zone. Easy fix.
Yeah, and the only thing I will add here is that what we did in June made it a quasi-legislative action going to the hearing examiner. What we are proposing here that is go back to a Title IV legislative process, which means property owners will still have the ability to do it, but it will have to come before the planning commission.
It'll be an annual review.
Annual review, and then you will review it and make a recommendation and go to the council.
It'll make it harder for somebody in the rural area to change, but that was the hearings board ruling, so that's what we're doing. So urban reserve, I'll give you a little more explanation about that. In the pre-June 28th, code, Title 40, was an urban reserve district with a use table in it. And the problem we identified, there's a couple of problems, but one is we had an urban reserve district actually on the map, and we had urban reserve overlay. We had both governed by this one section. The other thing we've discovered is when we took a look at some of this urban reserve is, for at least for the urban reserve district, there was no underlying zoning. And you would say, well, there wouldn't be. It's an urban reserve district. It's a zoning district. So what we proposed to do in, so we had this all along. It was a section in 4210, I think, over 40. So what we said was, let's make urban reserve a true overlay, and we'll make sure that it overlays a zone. And for the places that we that didn't have a zone, we made those R5. Because even though it says urban reserve, it's a rural zone. It's land that's outside of but adjacent to urban growth boundaries, right? And we thought it was a pretty good idea. There's some urban reserve out there now that's in overlay. It was in the overlay part, but it's in ag, and that's never been challenged, oddly enough. That's gone through the 04 plan, the 07 plan, and now this plan. Fisher-Wise got a hold of this and said, no, by the use list you have in creating this overlay, you're allowing all these uses to take place in rural areas. And the hearings board bought it. Neither of them realized that this was language that was in the code all along.
Yes, they did.
Well, they did.
Yeah, they did.
Well, they sure didn't come across that way in the reading of the document. It looks like they just said, this is new. It's not new.
And
we've had urban reserve and a use list for a long time.
No. Here's where they did it. We changed the comp plan by doing this, so that made it appealable.
Sure.
And they say that there are urban uses allowed in the agricultural zone.
And
their
favorite
thing to complain about is the bus barn.
Sure.
Up by La Center,
right,
which they say is an urban use in the ag zone.
Whatever.
And since we had changed the comp plan, even though the terms were the same, they got to appeal it.
Sure.
And that was what the growth board said. You're allowing urban uses in the agricultural zone.
Which is not really true.
Yeah.
But the fix.
It isn't?
No. If you go to the use list and tell me what's an urban use that's
the
allowed.
The bus barn.
Okay, we'll move on.
The fix is we're going to leave it as an urban reserve overlay, which solves our original problem, and we're going to delete the use list. So that's actually in your staff report. And well, basically, the uses and the development standards will revert to the underlying district. Easy fix. So that's the proposal for urban reserve. More of an explanation if you wanted, but that's the fix. We picked a number out of the air for maximum size for rural industrial land bank. The two that we have are 602 acres, so we said, fine, maximum size is 700. Done. Easy fix. If you want to go higher or lower, make the recommendation. That's just a number we've got. It's totally arbitrary, but that's what we stuck in the code. And the last one is Oliver alluded to. City of Battlegrounds didn't seem particularly interested in fighting there for their 80 acres, so there'll be a listing of those 17 parcels, those 80 acres, will come out of the Battlegrounds UG and we'll go back to R5. So those are the list of things that we're proposing to do. There's language and information about that in the staff report.
If I may add, this may be editorial on my part, but if you look at this list, it's just going back to where things were before the action was taken, literally.
Like option one?
Yes.
Option one. Sounds like we might have known what we were talking about.
Yeah.
With some things from...
Yeah, yeah, the things that were going to appeal.
Yeah. So, what we're proposing are changes to the map. That'll be three rural designations. Urban reserve will look like an overlay. Ag will change. Mostly it will change in the legend. It won't say ag 20. The color doesn't change. The parcels don't change. There'll be some text changes. We're adding the three rural designations and the language about 700 acres for rural industrial land bank. And we're making some changes to Title 40. And those those are the major ones are listed in their entirety, those sections in your staff report. And I think that's...
Is this what was referred to as the emergency ordinance, or is
nope.
there...
No,
you
no,
got another,
no.
You got another shoe to drop here. Okay.
Yeah, we're coming to that. And by the way, we have produced a map that we will also bring to your hearing. So we will bring the maps so that you see visually what is it that we are proposing as a way to come in compliance. And we will post this map on our web page. It will be difficult to read, but it will become available. All these things that we are doing, we are posting them on our web page so that the public will have an idea of what is it that we are doing in order to come in compliance.
So
here's our next steps, and then maybe you want to talk about the ordinance. Commerce review is in progress of all these things. We have to go back to Commerce, 60-day review. Here's your work session. We're going to adopt 2000 EIS and the supplemental EIS as part of this process. That's our environmental backstop, if you will, for documentation. The board will have a work session. June 7th, and their hearing is on June 20th. And assuming they adopt an ordinance that day by the charter, that takes effect 10 days later, which will be June 30th. And then after that, I'm assuming it goes, Chris does her magic, it goes back to the hearings board, and we see what they say.
Is the supplemental EIS changing?
No, we are
adopting. Didn't we already adopt it?
Right.
No, we're adopting. With these changes that we are making,
we're adopting it again as our environmental document for these changes.
Any other CEPA work? That's it.
Okay. So the document doesn't change, but we're adopting it again.
Correct.
So
for these changes.
For the changes that are undoing the changes from before. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Got it?
Yeah, I got
Makes
it.
Sense, does.
Yeah, I got it.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, the yeah. Okay, so I don't call it an emergency ordinance. I call it an interim ordinance. That's
right.
What it's called in the statute. So pursuant to RCW 35 63 200, a county can adopt an interim ordinance without public notice and without a public hearing. Must do so in a public meeting, and it must hold a public hearing within 60 days of the adoption. So on April 25th, the board adopted a moratorium on accepting a number of applications or pre-applications. And these are applications for land divisions in the Ag 10 and Forest 20 zones, and in the R20 and R10 zones, and they also put a moratorium on apps and pre-apps to rezone from R20 to R10 or R5, and from R10 to R5. So that's what the interim ordinance does. This was enormously, enormously important to Friends of Clark County and FutureWise. In exchange, FutureWise, Friends of Clark County actually had appealed on every issue where they lost to the growth board. They had filed their appeal in Thurston County, the rats. And so we would have been there defending the growth board's actions that said that they had no jurisdiction to rule on annexations, that did not uphold the complaints about water availability They complained about our critical areas ordinance and review, and the growth board found in favor of the county on that. They complained about our capital facilities plan and our transportation funding. The growth board upheld the county on that. We would have been in Thurston County defending all of those things, and particularly the water issue and the annexation issue are things that I did not want to have to re-argue. They were difficult to begin with. I thought arguing them again in a potentially unsympathetic forum was very risky. So, the county issued the moratorium. Friends of Clark County withdrew its appeals. They are not appealing any of these items that were issued in favor or found in favor of the county. We are hoping to have the hearing on, and planning is scheduling the hearing, the public hearing that will be duly noticed and have public participation in the whole bit on the densities in the resource zones and the rural area on June 20th. So that'll meet the 60-day deadline. It will be in front of you before it gets to the board. So we'll go through the whole legislative process with that. Now, in the meantime, there are something between 20 and 25 applications and pre-applications that have been submitted to community development to divide land in the Ag 10, Forest 20, and rural areas. If those applications or pre-apps are contingently vested or vested, the moratorium does nothing to unvest them. We don't think we can unvest something that's already vested. That's the whole idea of vesting. Once it is, it is. And so those land divisions, which will affect somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 acres, may still be in effect. There's one I'm not sure whether they're going to get their, well, there are a few that may or may not get contingent vesting, depending on whether what they've submitted meets the standards. But if they do, there they are, and they proceed. But nobody else will come in while the moratorium's in effect.
Any questions?
So this slide is out of date already because this one, you can take this off here. That's the,
yeah.
That's done. So.
And it was also only Friends of Clark County. FutureWise actually didn't appeal.
If you're interested, this is the, I know that's a long website, but it's just it's the county's website, community planning. If you do comprehensive/growth/management/plan, that'll take you to a page that lists all the issues, and we're trying to keep it up to date in terms of the information that Chris and Oliver and I just presented you. So.
And if I may add, we will make the change and post this on your website as well. As Chris indicated, yes, the board or the council adopted the interim ordinance. As you can imagine, it was a very, very difficult vote, but they did.
I don't think any of them were delighted about
it. That's what I mean. It was a very difficult vote, you can imagine.
Yeah.
And here we are. So your hearing is coming up May 18th. Some of you, with the exception of the new Planning Commission members.
Is it going to be another GMA hearing?
You know,
are we going
well,
to get the polar opposite lining up?
I don't know, but you all went through this.
Something to look forward to.
Yeah, you went through this. I know what your recommendations were, but we're not going to relieve that. It's coming back, and
we're required to bring
the changes. We have to come in compliance, and that's what
the unchanges back before the planning commission. Yeah. So we'll see you in 2 weeks. Other questions about? Again, it's in
Chris.
Data's in your information's in your staff report. The code changes, the language that we're going to add to the comprehensive plan text. We've summarized the map changes for you. We've got the maps, and if there's anything you want to take a look at. So if you've got questions, certainly ask it when we present, making the same presentation at the hearing in 2 weeks.
Have you heard about House Bill 1504, which is the short line of the railroad?
Yes. I don't know what its effect is going to be, and I don't know that the governor has signed it.
Or will sign it.
There's also a bill that I believe passed to undo the court decision on water availability and quality, and the governor has not signed that.
That's sitting on his desk.
Right.
Question for you, Chris. That no man's land where the applications slip through.
They didn't slip through.
Well, they're allowed to go forward even though it's being appealed.
Yeah.
Is that something Olympia would have to basically pass an ordinance or a bill that would say, hey, if it's appealed, all things are stopped until it's resolved?
Well, that wouldn't.
No.
It would be broader than that, and yes. There is state statute that establishes vesting with regard to land divisions and also with regard to building permits. There's also many, many, many years of case law by the Supreme Court, the Washington Supreme Court, on vesting. In addition, there's Clark County Code that implements vesting in Clark County. So there would be a lot of changes that would be required to change the system of vesting that Washington State now has.
The last single question. Superior Court has these cases. We've got 6 months with the planning board. If we do nothing, are we penalized?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So we lost on, what is it, 7 issues?
I think that's what you said.
And they determined invalidity only with respect to one of them. That's an extraordinary penalty. So they said that our density changes were non-compliant, but they didn't determine that was invalid, and invalid means that it substantially interferes with the goals of the Growth Management Act. They did not make a determination of invalidity. My very strong thought is that if the county were not to do something to something with respect to that particular issue, the densities and the resource zones, before the statement of compliance is due to the growth board, that they would impose invalidity at that time. They can do it at any time that they want to. In addition, we're pushing to get these compliance issues going quite quickly with you and with the board, because if we can get that accomplished and convince the growth board that we, A, have come into compliance, and B, should no longer be considered invalid, we can go to them early. Yes. And say, we want to have a hearing right now. Here's what we've done. Other side gets 2 weeks to respond. Please, schedule a hearing for the day after they respond. And that's in the statute that we can ask for that, and that they can grant that. So if we are in the kind of condition that I hope we will be in, when we get there, I will certainly go to them as early as possible and try to remove all these penalties.
And in addition to that, Bill, you raised a question about non-compliance and ability of the county to apply for state grant and so forth. Our goal is to do whatever we can to come in compliance, because what we want to avoid is having Clark County be at the bottom of the list when it comes to applying for state grants and so forth. So you and I, when you were with the county, it took us, again, 7 years, and the county at the time lost a lot of money.
Millions.
So
$110 million
Yeah, so we want to really avoid that. The other issue raised is one that Chris touched upon, that there are so many other statutes that could complicate, because what you're really asking is there any way that, hence the growth plans are adopted, there will be no actions until appeal is completed?
Somebody could keep appealing
Appeal forever.
And never get anything done.
You won't get anything done. That's why it's
wouldn't
kind
work.
Of difficult.
So with the 2007 comp plan, for those of you who didn't live through that period, while being active here, it took 7 years. The county went to the Washington State Supreme Court ultimately and won on some things. We won from the growth board on up to the Supreme Court in pieces and lost on other pieces. And the things that we lost, we undid and came into compliance, and the things that where we won, you know, they remain as they were. But that was 7 years. Now we got a stay from the growth board of some of their non-compliance and invalidity determinations once we'd been appealing for about 3 years. They did grant a stay so that Bill and his co-workers at Public Works could get those applications in.
Yeah. So hairs will never grow back.
They were lost in a good cause.
Yeah, took up for the team, though.
So I wanted to ask, on the 20 or 25 applications that are in, that are vested, are those on the newly designated land, or like the where it was 20 and now it's 10, so now they're coming in?
All,
and then it got held up, so now, but they got vested first.
Yeah, all Ag 20, all of it became Ag 10.
Okay.
All Forest 40 became Forest 20.
Okay.
The applications are primarily on ag land.
Okay. Including the largest ag parcel in the county, which is about 420 acres.
And there's another. That's a big one.
I think the largest single parcel has an application to subdivide.
And that is vested. That will move through.
Well, it is. I don't believe the determination has been made yet, so we shall see.
Yeah.
Some of them are contingently vested. They're not fully vested yet, but they are contingently vested.
So, Chris, do those become non-conforming right away then?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. They sure do.
Yeah, when they go through, they'll be non-conforming, yes.
Okay. To match the other 80% of the parcels that are non-conforming at the moment, due to size. We'll bump that up a few percentage points.
For whatever we can take from this, I think the issue is really when the ruling comes down, we look at some of the discussion, deliberations, which you all are part of, and then it becomes, what do we do to come in compliance? And there are other avenues left for the governors. We were asking that, could, although the governor rarely used that, but the governor can impose, as Chris was saying, if we get to an order of validity, there are consequences, and then the other penalties that is available to the governor. If we, the county, were to get to a point where an order of invalidity is issued, it could literally stop accepting applications.
So it's the equivalent of a moratorium.
A moratorium, yeah.
When there's an order of invalidity, you can't take applications. So.
No, and you may stop, in that same venue, you stop taking, when you stop taking application, you stop assessing impact fees and other things. So that's really,
right.
That's huge.
Right now, the only order of invalidity has to do with the land in the urban growth that was taken into the urban growth boundaries. We expect to remove the battleground land from the urban growth boundary. And the land that was taken into the Ridgefield and La Center urban growth boundaries was annexed, so the county doesn't get any applications for it anyway. It's governed by the cities. So that piece is of somewhat limited effect, that piece of the invalidity. My major concern is with loans and grants.
That's all we have. Let's see, our questions.
And they were all good questions.
Yeah. We're looking forward to the 4th of July. Take a day off.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, you haven't heard yet, huh?
One more last thing before you go. Some of you may have received this letter from the county asking you to, I think the subject line is participate in Clark County results identification and definitions. And there is a link for you to take a survey. And they provided an example of how other jurisdictions have ranked, what is important to them. So open the survey and, you know, participate. What is happening is that the county councillors have decided to go towards what is called a priority-based budgeting, where they rank programs and so forth. So that will give them idea of how important, if you will, those programs that the county provide, and use that in making policy call on budgeting. So I just want to make sure that if you receive them, open the survey, take that and send it back to them. It might be helpful in their decision or budgeting process.
I think it last night, it only took a few minutes.
Okay, yeah.
There's only a couple of minutes, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.